You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
So, what are you guys going to do? You going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires?
They said all along, perfection is not possible. We just want to get the big decisions right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
Green room getting hot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
The right answer was a goal in Times Square so we could do butts up. But that was an easy one.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from Brooklyn, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental. I am Andrew Wiebe, in the humble abode of one David Goss. Dave's
welcome,
here,
welcome.
Bobby Warshaw's here. It's a semi-off day for us, and so we come... is this a housewarming party? Could we call this a housewarming party? A housewarming podcast? What do you think?
Officially, the housewarming party is not allowed to happen until I put more things on the wall. So officially, this can't be registered at a housewarming party. Otherwise, my girlfriend will be mad at me.
Right. The decor is in progress.
Yeah.
A lot of beautiful artwork sitting on the ground. A lot of boxes and or bags. I won't shame you. I won't give you your address. But this is very Dave because we have both the niceties that I would expect your girlfriend to have. And also soccer books stacked haphazardly everywhere.
Yeah, there's some good ones. If you guys need to grab a book, I got plenty of books. That's one thing that I've been told I have too many of.
You picked up one on the street.
I just picked one up on a brief history of Indonesia.
That is Brooklyn.
Yeah.
That is David Goss for you. Can I ask you one thing?
Yeah.
Before we get to midweek action, because I'm mourning the fact that we no longer have midweek MLS this year. It'll be back in 2019, of course, before we set the stakes for the second to last
although we do
weekend
get
of the
midweek
regular
playoffs.
Season. What?
We do get midweek playoffs.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
Yeah, it's better.
Yeah, but it's not as bizarre and weird, and that's what fair. I like about it. What did you have to get rid of against your will that still rankles you, that it just still feels like an injustice?
Great
deep
question.
Down?
I love this question.
Yeah. Well, I gave away like 4 bags of clothing. So I gave away a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but sentimentally, clothing doesn't – it's not going to be clothing. Clothing was never going to be.
But for me, it's like the knockoff T-shirt with the picture of every player from the New York Mets from the 2004 home opener. Those are my clothings that I've, like, collected and kept, which I was forced to give away.
Gotcha.
So it's things like that. It's like the, like, preseason NIT T-shirt that I bought at MSG in 2001 for no reason. Couldn't tell you a single player that was on the court that day.
You sound like terrible.
But had to keep the T-shirt.
It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place. Come visit Dave if you're in Brooklyn Heights. Just walk around. Look for falafel shops. It's somewhere in the general vicinity. All right, let's get into it. Midweek MLS. I had a great time last night. DC Toronto. Wayne Rooney going semi-viral, I would say. I mean, one of the best free kicks I've seen in the league this year. Also, we've got KC. On the brink of the knockout round, coming back down 1-0 and just landed on Vancouver. And, of course, Orlando and Seattle, which I almost don't even want to talk about. It was so pathetic at times from the Lions. Rooney, that free kick, how did you react to it? My baby had just gone to sleep. I jumped up and down, screamed inaudibly while my girlfriend said, if you wake him up, there's going to be hell to pay. Because I had made her go through the dinner process, the bath process, because I had quote-unquote work, a.k.a. I was watching soccer. How did you experience that goal?
This is an inspirational talk. I was watching the game here and was pretty pumped about it. It was like one of those where you're like, oh, moments. Because you watch and you're like, yeah, that's like the top level of what I'm going to see. It was pretty filthy when it went in, and so I was pretty pumped about it.
It was amazing, but can we talk about how Alex Bono would have stopped it if the wall wasn't there? Is this a bad time to bring that up?
No, this is the
why
right
is
time.
Why is that an assumption?
I mean, I texted you, and
yeah.
I said,
I mean,
oh
has
my
that delay.
God.
It's that, like, delay as it comes around the wall, and if he has full sight on this thing, I just think his footwork is, from the start, you have a read on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of these weird soccer things we've done because it's always been done before, but there's no reason to have a 4-person wall there. And I love the way Yamil Assad stands and crouches in a wall. It is one of my favorite things in Major League Soccer this year. The way he like gets on a knee or bends over. I love that ingenuity, but just I wish we talked about walls more often, guys. That was just a bad decision to have a wall, and it cost them a goal and the point.
I got to tell you, I have not noticed this Yamil Assad wall building technique. What's he doing? He's just in the wall, just distracting.
Well, players usually, from the attacking team, usually stand in the wall to block the eye line of the goalkeeper, right? But they usually stand there. Yamil Assad this year has, like, gotten on one knee. This time he crouched over. He's just doing all these different things we almost never see, and they've worked. I mean, what was the first free kick Wayne Rooney scored is when Yamil Assad got on a knee so the goalkeeper couldn't see through his legs.
So that's why he's getting on a knee, because that's the part I'm failing to understand. He's blocking the angle of the ball strike as opposed to the path of the ball once it's been hit, or...
So the wall takes a near post, right? And then it's the attacker's job to stand between the wall and the goalkeeper and literally, like, try and figure out the area the goalkeeper wants to look through, because the defense would leave a gap, or they might just go to the side of where the goalkeeper looks through. It's the attacker's job to find the exact line between the goalkeeper and the ball and stand there and ensure the goalkeeper can't see until late.
So you lay down. I never thought about that. They're looking through the legs. Yamil Assad's down there pretending like he's tying his shoe. Meanwhile, he's blocking the sight. Wayne Rooney gets a free kick goal that gives him three more points. That's now four straight wins for DC United. They're unbeaten in eight. They're 4 points ahead of Montreal, all out of games in hand. They're one back of Columbus. They're actually just three back of the Union. So if the Union lose this weekend at home to Red Bulls and DC beat NYCFC at home, they would be tied with the Union, potentially moving in to a home game in the knockout round. This is insane, because I went back and looked at it. They were in last place for 15 weeks. 15 consecutive weeks of just, like, do not resuscitate DNR flatline in the middle of this season. And then Rooney comes towards the back third of that. He has his first game. They sit in last for five more weeks. And then it's like, you know, it's like Lazarus. They're back from the dead, man. They're just, like, out of nowhere. All of a sudden, they've jumped in the playoffs, and it's a foregone conclusion, I feel like, at this point, that they will be there, because if Montreal loses at home to Toronto FC, which is by no means a guarantee, Toronto did not look good in this game. Jozy Altidore says he's going to have surgery on that foot and ankle already, another surgery. Montreal could be out. This is, and I went and looked through all the season graphs for, like, the last 8-9 years. There is nothing that looks like this. Nothing. Even the Sounders in 16 were in last place for, like, 1 week. One isolated week, and climbed back up.
SKC 2011, when they built their stadium.
I covered that. And that is a very interesting one. And they were in last place for a while, but not nearly as long into the season. I think, like, May was the last time they were last place. But they made it from worst to first. So it's a little bit different. This one is, it's unique in every single way. And Wayne Rooney's the difference. If you look at the splits between the two, without Wayne Rooney, 2 wins. With him, 11 wins. The win percentage jumped, like, 50%. The goals for didn't really jump. 0.3 per game. It's the goals against, which is 1.1 to 2.1. But what isn't kind of spoken in that is that Russell Knauss is the same exact split. He came back the same game as Wayne Rooney, and they've made this run since then. Bill Hamid came back in mid-August. But now it looks like they'll have to go on the road in the knockout round where they don't win, because that is the elephant in the room. This entire run for DC United is built on home form. Do you have faith in DC, the playoff team, given that they will almost certainly be on the road?
To be fair, they didn't play away games without Wayne Rooney. So we actually don't know about the away form of this team as presently constructed.
They played 4 away games with Wayne Rooney. They have won none of them. But they were tough games. It was Atlanta. It was the Red Bulls. It was NYCFC. It was Montreal. All either playoff teams or their direct competitor.
They didn't draw at NYCFC?
They did. NYCFC and Montreal, they drew. The other two, they lost.
Yeah. Do I have belief in them? Is that the question?
Do you believe in them as a playoff team?
No, I do not.
Because right now it's really easy to believe in them as a team that will make the playoffs and the hottest team in the Eastern Conference. But their entire kind of, like, the looking glass that you view them through once we hit the playoffs changes completely.
You said that very matter of fact. You do not.
I just think in Major League Soccer, if you have weaknesses at certain positions in the playoffs, it's too hard to overcome, and one of their weaknesses is center back. I'm still not impressed. And when I watched them against FC Dallas last week and, like, a TFC 2 team this week, they still give up big opportunities, and a lot of them come from any time either you get one-on-one on the wings or you get behind Russell Knauss, whether he's pulled out of position because of passing or just because it's an overload in that space. People then create chances. If Maxi Urruti can do it, then Kaku can do it. Then Justin Miram and Federico Higuain can do it.
I'm with you that you need strong center backs, but you're going to tell me that Alexander Collins and Maxime Cheneau or...
I didn't say that.
Yeah, you just cherry-picked the team that nobody
has
faith in.
Then I'll go to Jonathan Mensah and Lalas Abubakar.
Again, not the problem, though. They can't score. Crew can't score.
But Austin Trussi and Marley. Like, who in the East does make you feel good about their center backs except the top two.
Okay, that's fair, although I would take Mensa and Abubakar over.
But not by Burn. A mile. They're not lockdown center backs.
No, I would agree with that. Also, when you talk about Trusting McKenzie, and we're going to talk about this, I think, a bit later, you're questioning can they step up and play in high-pressure situations. But, like, man-to-man right now, I think they're talented enough to be better than Briant. I don't know about Burn.
Honestly, I'd also take the fullbacks on almost all those teams over DC United's fullbacks. O'Neill Fisher not coming back. So you're talking about...
Although Nick DeLeon in the attack was unbelievable yesterday and, like, registered 50% of DC's attacking opportunities. Like, he was all over the
field. And Mora's been good the last 2 months. He was bad his first whatever in Major League Soccer, but he's been good lately.
He's been fine.
Yeah, that's a
good word.
I'd put him into good.
Okay. Bobby Warshaw's got him on the good scale. Yeah. So you have faith in this team in the playoffs. Let's say, and I'm just going to throw out a scenario because that's what this time of year is all about, that DC United finishes sixth. There's a good chance they'll finish fifth. Let's say they finish sixth and they're going to take on the Union in this case, because I think NYCFC is going to continue to crater. They'll lose the DC this weekend, and then it'll just be
watch
all
NYC wins at DC.
Philly DC, New York City DC, Columbus DC. Is there a matchup there that's best for DC?
I don't have an answer to that exact question, but they are within the spectrum of winning any of those matchups, right? Maybe they're not the favorite, but it's 55-45 no matter who they play.
I agree with that.
Right? And that's all you can
but
ask for.
But it is
a
across
game.
The board in that group of four teams, it is. For all of them, right?
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. So does DC have a chance? Are they made to win in the playoffs? Absolutely. They're within the spectrum of going out on a single game and getting a result that's not a fluke result. The best matchup, I still think, and this is weird for me to say, I still think everyone's best matchup in the playoffs is probably playing against Philadelphia. You know, I'm still concerned that Philadelphia doesn't have the high-end star to win you a playoff game. They don't quite have the pressure, the grit, just like that intangible, like, we're going to mess you up on this, like, cold, late October night and just find a way to grind out a result, which is somewhat contradictory to how much I love them all season, but I'm worried about them winning a playoff game.
I take away the Toronto game. I thought they were good in the Toronto game, but I thought it was a bad Toronto team. And we talked about this a bit on Monday. Their performance against FC Dallas was not inspirational to me. And that wasn't – I watched that game and was like, they can't find the ball in the spaces where they're dangerous right now. How's Lucho Acosta going to find the game? And he never did. So now you go into a playoff series and you say, okay, Will Trapp and Arter, Alexander Ring,
Bedoya,
these guys, yeah, okay, shut down Lucho Acosta because who else is going to find the game for them?
You make good points. You are right. It's not going to be easy for Lucho Acosta, but you said, no, they do not have a chance.
Okay,
so
fair.
Quick, which is null and void.
I love that you tweeted last night, Bobby, because I didn't have a great way of kind of like explaining what I was seeing. But when you watch DC play right now, it's Lucho dropping, it's Rooney dropping, and they're trying to find these areas to combine. And basically they're trying to find areas where they can just like ping these little passes back and forth to get that little inch of space that they need to play forward, probably into the other one, Lucho into Wayne and whatnot, and then make runs off of it. You had a good point about the rhythm that builds with Lucho Acosta. And when I look at Wayne Rooney right now, people went from the hot takes in my mentions being, this guy's going to be a high-priced bust, like, get out of here, retirement league, this is BS, to Wayne Rooney should be MVP. I got to imagine that Venn diagram overlaps a little bit of people that are just like, oh, got to have my mea culpa, so I'm going to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. He's unlocked Lucho. 8-9 with Wayne, 8 goals, 9 assists. Just 1 goal, 6 assists before.
So to go along with that Venn diagram of people, when he came in, there was like, you know, there's all the conversation. And one of the things we heard was like, well, maybe he'll play midfield, which we thought was ridiculous.
I said it. I thought it for sure.
But that's kind of what he's doing.
And I thought that he was going to take Lucho Acosta's spot.
Well,
I got no problem owning up to that.
But that's kind of what he's done is he plays center forward, but he drops in and finds the game and creates for their team. It's not like he stretches the field. It's not like he has to play with his back to goal most of the time. He basically just is a fourth attacker along that front line, which gives them even more versatility to, okay, if him and Lucho want to combine and there's someone sitting in the middle of the field defending that, they can both move to one wing and start to find the game there and create off of Stieber or off of Assad, whoever it is that's over on those sides.
I also think that's a weakness, though, to go back to their playoff persona and like how these other teams might deal with them. I think if you clog that space and you take away some of that easy combination, there's not an outlet for them if you're able to keep those two guys from penetrating. Like, where do you go at that point? Is Yamil Assad going to – I mean, he can create something out of nothing, but his is more off that same – it's not really the like, hey, okay, big switch or ball over the top or run onto this or stretch the field. It's the same sort of combination play that opens them up. And if you can ugly it up a
little bit – I would disagree with that.
Really?
I think Yamil Assad is your field stretcher on that team. And you saw it a little against Serrano. He just was offside on that unreal goal. But, like, if you start
again,
to
– but that was – Rooney found space.
No, no. But that's the point is you start to creep in on Rooney and Lucho. He can physically stretch the field. If someone can hit that ball properly, he can come off the wing, but you can break the line between a center back and a fullback on the ground, and he runs onto that. And that's the same as breaking the line for Kai Kamara or I was trying to think of a fat – like Giassi Zart. You know what I mean? It's the same concept. He's just coming from a different position. I think he is the one that brings that to that team because I agree. Stieber is the similar player to the other guys, and he wants to get involved in the same way and play the same way. And then the other thing is the fullbacks, which O'Neill Fisher was big with. And I'm telling you, Nick De Leon's, if they go far, Nick De Leon is going to be a guy we talk about a lot.
You're thinking about that Rookie of the Year campaign.
Yeah, dude, I'm all in.
So like, Nick De Leon did not get his due. We've got to find this out. DC with a big game against New York City. We'll talk about that in the second segment. Vancouver basically done and dusted at this point. They go up 1-0 against Kansas City at home. Kansas City had to win. Their fans are freaking out. Felipe scores this left-footed volley, a really nice goal off the setup from Kai Kamara, and they're like, oh, crap, it's happening again. We're going to be the fifth seed. We're going to be on the road in the knockout round. All these like little insecurities within Sporting KC fans that have existed since that MLS Cup victory just came out full bore on Twitter, and maybe this is just my personal timeline because I tend to follow all these people. And then Johan Kwaze with a banger out of nowhere, inspired by Doyle's hatred. Daniel Shalvey, Gianluca Busio get it done. Kansas City 4-1. They're riding high. They're like, you know what? Dallas, LAFC in the final 2 weeks, forget the knockout round. We're getting that bye. Maybe even going to win the conference. All well and good. I'm just saying I'm on the Gianluca Busio hype train. I committed to the hype train minutes before he scored the goal. I've been like, you know, I've been at the turnstile with my ticket for a while. Didn't
Brian
know if I was
Reynolds
gonna get on.
In the passenger seat. Gianluca Busio driving the train.
Who's what?
Brian Reynolds.
Yeah, I'm with you. Busio's great. You know, the nice thing about this win for KC is it feels like their first close game against a good team win in a while. You know, the game against Seattle, in the last 2 months,
the
they've had
the Galaxy where yeah, they couldn't get the winner.
Exactly. They've played well. They've looked like the better team. Sorry, Sounders fans, but I'll stick to that they were the better team against Seattle. And they just haven't found a way to win, right? They still only have 3 wins against playoff teams this year. So it must feel good for SKC to not only stay away from that play-in game, but also to have just beaten a good team in a tough game.
What do you credit that to? Just 3 wins against playoff teams? Because it's kind of one of those stats where like, this could be a fluke, but in a lot of ways you look at it and say, well, you didn't beat the teams that you're going to have to beat to get where you want to go.
I would put them in the same category as Columbus right now and Philly, DC, the 2 games previous to this one where can you be a possession team who keeps the ball and also be a team that is dynamic and creative and unpredictable? And both Columbus and SKC right now verge more on just possession and keeping the ball without finding ways to do that last action toward goal, right? You can either do it systematically through your possession, which is really, really hard. You have to be sharp. You have to have good movement off the ball. Or you can move the ball to a spot in which a player takes his chance. And I don't know on either of those teams, Columbus or SKC, the player that's going to take that opportunity. Maybe Johnny Russell. And when I say that, right, like you move the ball to the corner of the 18 where Raheem Sterling or Leroy Sané get it for Man City, and then they take someone on, they get to the end, they play the easy ball across. Who's doing that for SKC? Maybe Johnny Russell a little bit, but I'm just worried they don't have that guy that when they get to the right moment can execute.
Matt Beasley makes that run into the box, puts it right on the foot of Johan Kwaze. Bangs the top corner. I'm just kidding. Beasley will not be that guy. That was when he made that run. I was like, where's Matt Beasley going? And then it worked out pretty well for them. Go back to Gianluca Busio. And you tried to move me past this. You tried to make your Brian Reynolds jokes. I get it. But when he came into the game, I thought he was the difference mm-hmm. when it comes to those penetrating passes. The pass that you're not expecting. The little slip pass. The one that he looks you off a little bit. He takes a chance. He plays it one time. For being a 16-year-old, 16 years, 142 days, by the way, for being the second youngest player to score a goal in MLS history, he shows remarkable vision and maturity. And this was a high-pressure moment. That's what I liked about it the most from him, is that they needed to find a way through. They had to break this team down. They had to get a win. This was a must-win game for Kansas City in a lot of ways as it pertains to their confidence in the playoffs. For him to step up in that way in this moment for this team and for to have Peter Vermes give him that chance, it just – these are the things that give me tingles when I watch this league.
And he was active, right? He was right in the heart of the action. Some young players kind of fade to the side and wait for that 1v1 opportunity or don't like to be in the tangle right in the middle of the field. Busio was like, I'm here. Give me the rock in this tough spot. I'll make something happen. That's the part that I liked the most, was just his willingness to go to where it was hard and try and find a way.
Who do you start at forward? If you're Peter Vermes, it's a big game. Kyrie Shelton is back.
Two assists last night.
Looks good. Still probably not going to be a goal scorer for you, but that's why you have the three guys in behind him.
Why would you not start Diego Rubio? I don't understand the question.
Because I think Kyrie Shelton makes the other guys better, whereas Diego Rubio, you're hoping to catch lightning in a bottle in some ways.
Well, I think that's an exaggeration because he played so well for so long. I also would wonder if you aren't starting Diego Rubio, do you lose Diego Rubio? Right? Like if he's a confidence player and that's Peter Vermes has to have him in the right place – is this team ceiling higher with Diego Rubio scoring goals in the playoffs? Yes.
But Diego Rubio scored a ton of goals off the bench before this year.
Okay, fair.
Before he was the best super sub.
But now you go and bench him again. It changes the mentality rather than you come into a season, there's question marks, you fight for your spot off the bench. Now you lose that spot.
Yeah, but Diego Rubio's not a dummy. Like, Kyrie Shelton was out. I know there's
but Kyrie Shelton doesn't score goals.
I know there's still a pride aspect for him, and I get where he'd be coming from on that.
It just seems like to me your highest ceiling is with him scoring for you. And so you, if I'm Vermes here, I'm going to try and find a way to win with him in the lineup before I go to Kyrie Shelton.
I'm going to take a different angle on this. I still think we undervalue the last 30 minutes of a game. You don't need to play your best 11 players for the first 60 and then sub them out when they're tired when you need to be winning the game at the end of 90. I'm a big fan of who's gonna win you the game at the end. It's okay if your center striker, who's your best center striker, doesn't start because then he's fresh when the game's open, when the other players are tired. So I would start Kyrie Shelton, keep yourself in it for 60 minutes, and then put in your goal scorer when the game's open and he can have more space to score.
Big decisions for Peter Vermes. FC Dallas this weekend. That game's at 5 p.m. Eastern. All the Eastern Conference games this weekend on Sunday are at 3. The national TV game, Atlanta and Chicago. And then at 5, all the Western Conference games, LA, Minnesota will be your national TV game there. We'll get to that in just a second. Finish here, Orlando, Seattle. Orlando are just, I mean.
Yeah, we already talked about it on
Monday.
I just don't even want to.
I can't imagine Orlando fans want to hear about it. Nobody wants to hear about it. It's the worst defense in MLS history now, alone, exclusively, 72 goals allowed in a single season, and they have two games remaining. They could hit 80. They could conceivably hit 80 the way that they're defending right now. They didn't even look interested last night. Didn't even look like they wanted to be there. They have one win in their last 22 games. They haven't scored, well, before they scored, which probably was offside, by the way. Looked pretty clearly offside. They hadn't scored since September 1st. I mean, Sam tweeted out, nobody looks like they want to be there. True. What's going on, though, with record scoring being allowed? Because Minnesota set the record last year with 70. They got 72. San Jose have 69. They'll go past 70. Minnesota have 65. I bet they go past 70, maybe even just against the Galaxy this weekend. Vancouver, 64. What would you attribute, Bobby, to the number of historically or approaching historically bad defensive teams this year in Major League Soccer? Is it the TAM effect?
We've talked about it on the show a couple times. Definitely the TAM effect, right? More money spent on attacking players, and usually that infusion of TAM is spent on attackers. And not defenders.
Or poorly on defenders.
But
we've
also
seen a lot.
But also just individual defending has gotten worse. And this is true all around the world, right? When you go around the training sessions around the world, it's passing, it's finishing. They're not working on individual defending technique. So defending.
Also the rules are geared towards attack, I think, now.
True.
More like the game is geared that way around the world, which I think is why focus has shifted from trying to perfect it because it's kind of impossible to some extent. And then the other thing is, I just think the high-end attacking players that you're buying in MLS. I mean, you talk about goal
scoring. Let's not let defenders off the hook. That's obvious. Anyone listening to this show knows that people are spending more money on attackers. Let's not let defenders off the hook. Like, that first
but
goal.
Like, Orlando went and got Lamine Sané. Vancouver pays Kendall Watson a lot of money. San Jose spent a ton of TAM. Affelter and Quintana and you know, Minnesota has Calvo and that's
gone up, but not in relation to the attackers.
So that, and that's what I was going to say, and I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I would say that one, the attackers.
I love that. What's cut you out?
I'm going to say the Almirones, the Kakus, the Javinkos are better than the best attackers were in MLS before. They're also younger, and so they play more minutes.
That was it, dude? That's what you're worried about getting in trouble for?
3 days ago, Doyle told us David Ferreira would be an elite number 10 in MLS right now, which I don't think is true.
Oh, yeah. He would still be elite.
I don't know about that.
Oh, man. Yeah, we had two of the best David Ferreira stands in the world. I love David Ferreira, but
that's fine.
Let's be honest.
And I'm not saying he wasn't a great player. But, like, when you look at if you're going to roll a bad defense out there, Atlanta's going to put up 5 against you. And I don't know that that's always been true. And Almirón's going to play 32 games in a year, which I also don't know has always been true. Like, because these guys are 6 to 7 years younger than the top attacking talent was previously in MLS. Like, when Juan Pablo Angel
and Guillermo Barros Galota. There's also just more of them. Think about the guys that you were watching as, like, you know, I think about when I first started covering this league day-to-day and the guys that Kansas City had that were their difference makers. Like, they were nobodies. They were signing Jefferson as a DP out of Brazil who was a nobody.
They sure as hell weren't Johan Quaze, I'll
terrible.
Tell you that.
But that's the point. Johan Quaze can walk into this team, and he's a DP, and we can bust them for that signing and be like, why did you spend a DP slot? Why did you spend the amount of money you did? Why did you pay a transfer fee? This guy's mediocre at best when you talk about the other guys who have entered there. But I remember, like I said, back in the day where you're like, they don't have anybody. There's nobody. It's like,
can I ask a question?
They didn't even have a profile.
Do you think pressing has changed that?
Pressing's made it harder. Pressing increases your risk of defending, right? It increases the reward because you win the ball in better spots, but if you don't do it well, it leaves you more exposed. So this whole idea of pressing and counter-pressing, yeah, it's great if it's done well, but there's still coaches in this league who don't do it well, and it's like trying to keep the ball. If you pass, you don't do it well, you expose yourself to counters. Pressing's the same.
That's interesting because I was thinking about it the other way, which is, it takes more advantage of more mistakes by poor defending. I was thinking about it in the attacking sense, not if you press poorly, you give up chances.
Oh, the fact that increased defensive pressure in the attacking third means more goals for more turnovers.
Yeah.
That's fair, too. But I don't want to let defenders off the hook. If you just watch players play now, they look less interested in defending, and their technique isn't as good, right? It's just like the bare bones. When you watch a game and a cross comes in, how often is the defender at the front zone with his hips open to the game? Right? That to me is the kind of thing that should be done 100% of the time. And if you are still running back or your body isn't open, you haven't checked your shoulders, or you haven't worked out who's in the front zone and who's taking the second defender or who's taking the second runner, then you don't deserve to play at the professional level. And one of my pet peeves, we give players a hard time for a lot of stuff, and we don't just crucify them for things like that. And if we did talk on more podcasts, write more things, then maybe they would do it more. They would be more accountable about it.
You think it comes... doesn't come from it comes from coaching, though, no? It comes from the guys that are making the decisions as it pertains to their livelihood. Just like if our boss has said, you need to do this more or whatever else, we probably would do it because that's the crux of the whole equation, which is money.
I believe in the ecosystem of things where the media says things, the fans say things, the coaches hear it. Like just everything seeps into everything else, right? So even though you don't hear it directly, just you hear it at some point into your subconscious, and it just lifts the overall quality of everything. I tell myself as a lie because that's what I want. But
yeah, can I make one just point? Because I've been sitting here looking at this as I thought about the difference in attacking quality from, I don't know, let's just say 2010, because that's what I looked up till now. The Golden Boot leaders in 2010, Wando with 18 goals atop, won the Golden Boot. Then it's Edson Buttle behind him, Dero, Omar Cummings with the Rapids, Sebastian Latou with the Union, Juan Pablo Angel, okay, Connor Casey, Saborio, Cunningham, Kai Kamara, Freddie Montero, Steve Zakuani. All those guys with double digits.
You've actually unconvinced me.
What, that it's better?
That's a good list of play. Omar Cummings pre-injury was filthy.
Yeah. Okay,
but Alvaro really Saborio was one of the best strikers right now in the region.
Okay, let's just say Nacho Piatti, who's way down the list this year. I mean, this year it's Joseph, Zlatan, BWP, Mauro Manotas, Young, Jossie Zardes, okay, that's a little bit of an outlier, Nemanja Nikolic, Piatti, Kai Kamara, Carlos Vela, Dom Dwyer, Miguel Almirón, Jovinko, David Villa, Christian Pena, Alexander Katai, Diamande, I mean, it like Darwin Quintero, Albert Elise. Just the depth here, it's not even in the same stratosphere.
We overvalue
great players in 2010. Don't let me like convince you that these are not good soccer players. I just think the depth and overall ceiling, it's a different world. It's a different world. All right, we're going to break. On the other side, Sunday.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental, doing our thing in Brooklyn, where there is beautiful light. You got great light in this apartment, Dave.
Yeah, I pay a light tax, so per metric of light, I have to pay extra.
Good one, good one. I thought I was the one with the terrible dad jokes,
nice.
But like I'm gonna have to file that one away for
now
later.
That I have property, I'm a curmudgeon-y old guy.
Yeah. Just so you know, he rents.
3 p.m. Eastern. You think I bought an apartment in New York City?
Yeah. I was going to say the neighborhood, but I won't out you like that. This weekend, it's pretty easy. If you want to watch the games, it's all on Sunday. It's a four-hour block, 3 p.m. Eastern. Eastern Conference goes down. Everything at the same time. Atlanta-Chicago on ESPN. Of course, in Atlanta, the big crowd. The opportunity to potentially lock down the supporter shield. They are up 1 point on the Red Bulls. So if they win, that would push them 4 points ahead. I'm wrong. Red Bulls could win, and then what am I talking about? Well, it could happen if the Red Bulls lose in Philly, which is conceivable. So still the possibility remains. Before we get to the Western Conference and Zlatan and everything else here, Atlanta, they got the Supporters Shield. They got MLS Cup. They got Tata in flux. They got Almiron in flux. They got potentially Joseph in flux. What happens if we get to the end of the season and they don't win a trophy, and they lose their most important assets as a club? Is it a conceivable – I mean, it's obviously conceivable. It could certainly happen. But what would it say about their first 2 years? Would it cheapen anything they've done? Would it change anything they've done? Should it change our opinion of their success? Because we've sat here in not this room, but a green room, and talked over and over and over about how they changed everything from recruitment to fan culture to scale.
It doesn't cheapen what they've done. It just doesn't take it to the next level. That we'll always remember Atlanta in these 2 years very fondly. We'll be very impressed. And you're right, they did probably change the paradigm. But it doesn't take them to the, holy crap, that team was amazing, and they'll be remembered for their overall quality on the field.
What if they never get back here because of the rest of the league catches up, or because they don't make the right decision on the next signing, or because Barco's a bust? I mean, how much is at stake for them in this last October 18th? How much is at stake in the last month and a half of this season?
I think I'm the wrong person to ask about this, so I don't know. I don't know that I'm going to like go there for you.
That's fine.
I've said many times on this show that Atlanta has a wonderful, wonderful situation, and I'm not sure we all, and certainly they don't appreciate how lucky they are right now. That yes, they spent a ton of money, but Almiron and Joseph have been so good. And I'm not sure $8 million guarantees that for him. I mean, look at Andre Horta. Look at Barco, right? Anytime you spend money in the world transfer market, it's always a risk, even if you spend more than everyone else. And if I were an Atlanta fan, I would be concerned about signing anyone that can be as good as, even if they are a star, to be as good as Almiron has been for the last 2 years.
And it's not just those two. Let's say Julian Gressel leaves this offseason or otherwise. You're not going to go get Julian Gressel in all likelihood in the super draft, in the position that you'll be picking as Atlanta United. That was one of those acquisitions that is definition of outlier. Like, you don't just go pick up a player that can slot in at right back or central midfield and not just do it, but be productive, which is what he's been the last 2 years, both in goals and assists.
Laurentiis a year older. Michael Parkhurst a year older. Brad Guzan a year older.
Garza.
But they can still go. But I don't understand.
He's like, wait, what?
He's at the back end of his career, isn't he?
Who,
I mean,
right?
He just got hurt. He had a terrible
Greg
injury.
Garza?
He just came back. Yeah, I mean, he's been injury prone. I love Greg Garza, but.
But also, you're talking about Laurentiis and Parkhurst. Like, there aren't other veterans that they can sign. The thing with Gressel is they're just going to have more money. You're getting more TAM money every year.
I get that, but once again, you have to spend that money on a TAM player, whereas Gressel's been, like, the best case scenario for you.
For sure.
On the field and from a cap situation.
Against the cap.
Garza's in his prime, Bobby.
They hit a home run
with Gressel, but like you can go at the, they can spend. That's the point. And they will spend, and they have spent. And you could question whether or not they're going to do it well, but they're still going to go out and get a higher profile player than most other teams in Major League Soccer.
But the windows are so finite. It's so finite. There's no guarantee you'll get back there. The rest of the league's improving. You have this opportunity.
But the rest of the league's improving like they're up and down. They've been in the league for 2 years. They've been one of the best teams in the league for 2 years.
And they haven't experienced really any bad luck. They haven't experienced any bad fortune. They haven't made bad signings. Maybe Barco will be one. And the bad signings they have made, they've been in a cover-up for them.
But they've had multiple – it's not just one thing that they've done well. They've had three – their star players have been great. Their role players that are mid-level cap hits have been great. They have Julian Gressel, who's a low cap hit, has been great. And they have a coach that has brought them all together, right? That is what has – those are the things that have all had to come together to get this version of Atlanta United. And do you think they'd be the same if they lost one of those, right? If they're mid-level players, if Lorenowitz and Parkhurst aren't this good in 2018 – are they still competing for a shield?
Yeah, that's not my issue. My issue is, why is there assumption that when these people move on, the next one won't be well? Basically, why is the assumption that this is lucky?
Because they have to do
it's
all
not,
four
it's
of
not
those.
Lucky.
But that's what they did.
Yeah, I know.
They're
I'm
a good
saying,
franchise. They
lucky.
Did it well once. Why can't they do it well?
And you know what? The Oakland A's did a great job producing three-star pitchers at once. Why haven't they done it again since?
I'm just saying it's hard for
okay,
us to be
replicable.
Okay,
that's fair. But also, the Oakland A's, if they had Arthur Blank as an owner, probably would have won the World Series every year.
Well,
things come together at the right
time. I don't
know,
the Falcons.
You can't be sure about anything. Yes, Bocanegra and Paul McDonough did a phenomenal job and deserve a ton of credit for the way they put that team together, but all you can do is try to get in this range of being right and hope that it hits.
Yep.
And all four of their things hit. And you can still be very good, put yourself in the range, and this doesn't work out, whereas they've had everything work out and come together.
And that's what I'm saying. This window is gaping. It feels like, you know, sometimes there are times where you have to walk through the door. Toronto FC in 2017, they had to break that door down. They had to get it done. Otherwise, you had this window, as we're talking about this year within CCL and also now missing the playoffs, where it's just this like, how does your club come back from it? If you lose your two most important pieces, which I would argue are Almirón and Tata, there's no like automatic fix for that. You may go get a Guillermo Barros-Schelotto, but there's no guarantee that he recruits the same way Tata did, that he inspires both sides of this locker room the way Tata did. Like, there's just no guarantees, which is why – like, yes, Atlanta United fans, I think, have taken for granted a little bit this level of success, but they may have to come to terms with a few things if they don't get it done this year. I just think there is a lot of pressure on them that we haven't really talked about because of the uncertainty, because of the growth of the league, because of where everything is going, and the fact that they're kind of fading right now, and their best player is hurt, and Barco's got to step up, and I don't know if he will. Nobody does. He might.
Do you think Barco gets – I'm not sure Barco gets the job. Because remember, they also have Escobar – who's been on the bench, and it feels like Tata's worked harder to get Escobar in the game. And you put Escobar right back, you move Julian Gressel up, you move Darlington Nagbe up. I mean, there's other ways to fill Almirón's shoes except Barco.
What do you think the most effective way is for this team? Final Ooh. Two regular season games, 1 point lead in the Supporters' Shield. They want to get that trophy, but ultimately they won MLS Cup.
The highest ceiling is playing the $15 million guy, right? If Barco hits, then I mean, going off of their general ability, maybe there's even more upside than with Almirón, but we've all seen that Barco can have bad games. And if you trust your level, if you trust your team, if you trust that Almirón will be back, then maybe you just put maybe Julian Gressel into midfield, you move Darlington up to your 10, you keep Vialba and Joseph up top. I mean, you can do things so that you don't have to force Barco into this role.
But can we also be real for a second? Whoever you play in there, you're going to beat the Chicago Fire.
That's a good point.
That's what LAFC thought. I mean, Chicago just smacked a very good LAFC team, handed them their only loss in over 2 months.
Okay, that's fair. But if you think there's a chance that it's Barco, then you have to play him this Sunday because it's an easier matchup than at Toronto on decision day to potentially win the cup and to potentially – or Supporter Shield and to potentially pass their record. And Giovinco's going to be back. I know Josie's getting surgery, but blah, blah, blah. So if you're going to at all do it, you have to do it on Sunday. And I think if Tata Martino is going to be here afterwards, which, by the way, it's October 18th, and so he already told us 17 days ago, but none of us know, which I find very fun.
Well, L3 apparently is going to break the bank, make him the highest paid international manager.
Yeah, but we all were told we'd know by October 1st. So that was a good way to get that one off. If you do have any future stock in this, you need to give Barco a chance to prove that he can be that guy and prove that, hey, one, next year, if Almirón's gone, it is my spot. both.
But it's a window. We've already established unanimously that they are in a window right now. You don't have this year to work towards next year. You don't have this year to grow.
We only have two games left. That's it. That's all we're talking about. We're not talking about for the 2018 season. We're talking about there's 2 weeks left. Almiron's hurt. You've got the number one goal scorer in the league. You believe you have one of the best defenses in the league. If you put Barco in there for two games against the Chicago Fire and this Toronto FC team, can you get 4 to 6 points?
Right, that's a fair argument. You're talking about 2019.
Well, I'm saying, but that's part of that is.
No, it's not. And I'm telling you, 2019 should have no factor in this equation.
Right. The one thing I do think you factor in is if Almiron, and it doesn't sound like he'll be an issue for the playoffs, if he is, you should both be using these two games to get the results you need for the Shield, because that's very important for your legacy and for the building of your club and just for the plaudits that everybody wants and needs in their professional lives. But also because you need to figure out what your, you know, first club out of the bag is, sans Almiron. Let's say this thing is worse than you thought. Let's say he has a setback. Let's say he gets hurt 20 minutes into game one of the conference semifinals. What are you going to? And these two games can potentially answer that.
Is it going to be Barco or no? I say no.
I say yes.
Okay.
I think it will be Barco. New York Red Bulls will be watching that one very closely. They're in action at the same time in Philadelphia. The Union have an opportunity to not only host a playoff game, but maybe get to that three seed. They're just 3 points back of New York City FC, who visit DC United this weekend. This is I think as you called it, Dave, a dress rehearsal for the playoffs for this young team. You have a Red Bulls team that comes in, needs a win, wants a win, not just because it's conference, because they have the Shield at stake. And you're a young Philly team trying to prove yourself that in these gut check moments, a la the Open Cup against a worse team, by the way, in the Dynamo, that you can step up to the plate and you can stand toe-to-toe with, I think the best team in MLS in the Red Bulls right now, sans Almiron at Atlanta.
Yeah, sans Almiron, I think everyone's probably going to agree with that, because I think it's a hair between the two teams anyway.
Yeah.
Throughout the season and, you know, throughout the opinion of most people that watch. So I would agree with that. I think Philly stepped up and played well in big regular season games that we've talked about, especially over the last 2-3 weeks with that game out in Seattle and then the home game against SKC and then going to Columbus right after Open Cup and getting the result.
Montreal being an obvious one as well.
Well, they got crushed against Montreal. So that...
The flip side.
Yeah.
Philadelphia, when you play against the Red Bulls, the biggest thing you need is a midfielder to transition the ball off of your defenders so that they don't get good opportunities from pressing you. And Philadelphia might have the two guys most equipped for that in Harris Madunian and Doris Bochkal. But and
Doris Burke / Borch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Being in Dave's apartment, we do have old NBA games just playing.
Old, right. 12 hours. Call,
right? So Philadelphia is an okay matchup against this Red Bulls team. Or should feel okay with the matchup against Red Bulls.
How did you treat games like this at the end of the regular season? Like, you're in the playoffs, you're good, but there's a... I mean,
yeah, like, does Jim Curtin
try
and... Yeah, does Jim Curtin try and put pressure on for them to figure out how they react in that moment? Or does he want to minimize pressure because then if they lose, it's a bigger letdown?
Jim Curtin's a bad example because he's a pretty steady guy.
Okay.
I don't think Jim ever gives a motivational speech like that.
He just shows Invincibles on DVD before every game. What if that was true? That'd be amazing.
He's like, all right, guys, I'm going to hit play here. Mark just Wahlberg. Let this go in the background. Love this line. Good stuff.
I don't have a good answer to that. I don't know. Every team is different, I think.
What was the end of the regular season like for you as a player?
I experienced all of them. We're in the playoffs. We're out of the playoffs. We're fighting for a playoff spot, and we're fighting for seed. And it feels... On this side of things, we like to think that in a locker room, there's a lot of talk and a lot of conversation, a lot of storytelling. But I'm telling you, when you're in there, it's like, hey, here's this game this weekend. Like, let's go win it. You know, maybe there's a little bit of a let's go get the seed or let's make sure we don't play the home game. But when you're in the grip of the season, you really it's going so fast and the wheel is turning where it's like, oh, Thursday, Friday, we've got a game tomorrow. Like, let's do our best to go win it. And you really don't get caught up in all the storylines.
Even if it's not verbal, there's no like – little change to the tone. There's no way that the consistency is the key. I get that you don't want to change things up, but I find it hard to believe that at this time of year, when you're starting to look perhaps failure or success or your budget numbers or your bonuses or whatever it is that you're planning for your job, that there isn't something that changes, that there isn't some little thing like in the way that the room feels or in the way that training feels or in the way that the weather comes in and everybody kind of gets a feel for the time of year or the pressure.
You're absolutely right that players think about all those things. I like that you brought a bonus because, remember, in almost every league, you have a statement in your contract that says if you play in half the games or 20 of the 30 games, and some players are one or two goals away from that. I remember when Zlatan gave Alessandrini the penalty kick a couple weeks ago, and it was Alessandrini's 10th goal of the year. I was like, I bet that was for a bonus. I bet Alessandrini had a 10-goal bonus in his contract. But, Andrew, to answer your question, I don't think there's a collective feel of that. The biggest collective feel, and this sounds bad, is that there's 30 guys on a roster. 10 to 15 of them aren't playing. 10 to 15 of those guys are ready for the season to end so they can go on vacation. That's the hardest thing at the end of any season, is that there's half the guys that are like, whatever, I don't care. I'm not playing. I want this team to lose. I'm ready to go to Cabo with my girlfriend. That's a real thing where half the guys are trying to fight and like really want to do it for the club and the fans and themselves, and other guys are just ready for it to
end. You can feel that in the locker room. Like you can look around the room and be like, that guy, I know that guy's like planning what swimsuits he's bringing. He doesn't like...
Absolutely.
How does that feel? Like I'm trying to think if we were sitting in this room right now and you were just like, I really don't care. Like, whatever, dudes, like... Talk about your stuff on your podcast. Like, if you look like idiots, that's cool with me. It doesn't really matter.
It's really frustrating. It's hard. I don't have anything else to put. It's something you have to navigate at the end of a season. That's why you have leaders and good management. And it's also, you think about the right part of the middle of the season. It's a manager's job to manage the personality so that this doesn't happen at the end, right? If you're a jerk to players, if you neglect them or you pick players over them, then come October when you really need everyone bought in, you're not going to have it.
Interesting. Which team do you have the least confidence in the Eastern Conference? I feel like we're pretty much set here. DC United, they're 4 points up on Montreal. They're out of games in hand. I think we've been saying this for a long time. I think they're going to be in the playoffs. They'll probably be fifth or sixth seed. You know, it's pretty set. The top two seeds are set, basically. Then you have New York, you have Columbus, you have Philly, and you have DC. Who do you have the least faith in to get a result in the playoffs?
Who's I guess NYCFC. I just haven't seen life from them in such a long time that we talk about this place they could go to, the team that they were, but I don't know that there's proof that they are that team anymore. And I don't know that saying Yangel Herrera might come back
and
is worth
Medina
it.
Off these, like,
Jesus Medina would
Jesus
be a big
Medina
one.
Jesus Medina more than Yangel Herrera. Yeah.
Jesus Medina would be a big one, but you're still in a place where it's like, well, what is the style of this team anymore, and how does he fit in, and – you know, where do you play him, and who is Maxi Morales right now? And I don't know. I don't really know a lot about this NYCFC team.
Does it feel like Domi Torrent played the locker room in the way that he needed to, like you're saying, Bobby, to have that buy-in at this point of the season? Because Patrick Vieira would have had it. He's shown that he did have it. He left. New guy comes in. He brings in new faces. He plays them over a lot of guys who've been playing a lot before under Vieira and having success, and then the results go.
Did Domi do it? I have no idea. This is one of those things where players in the locker room are like people outside of – you don't know unless you're there. You know, we can try and guess, but the truth is, this is one of those things you don't know. But also, are you guys undersell – did you try and say that Jesus Medina is a bigger return for NYC than Herrera?
I just Herrera after being out for a year.
Yeah, I don't know how you can –
for 4 months. He only got hurt in May, mid-May.
Yeah, but he's
– but how many soccer games has he played?
Zero, and we –
No, but there's like including that. He's played like five games this season?
Played the first
more than that,
10
like
or so.
14 or so, I think.
That's more than I thought.
And he wasn't great before he went out. But remember, he was hoping to get a move to Europe, and he had big plans. I mean, he's going to come back.
But again, that's a change. That's another change. You're shuffling things again.
But what's he going to come back in? A decision day game and then play a midweek playoff game?
I think this is a thing that we do, guys, where we're down on a team, and then they surprise us, and we're like, God, they really surprised us. And we should have been, well, actually, they got their three best players back.
That's fair.
And the thing I've been saying about Herrera the whole time is that Herrera is the player that Domi Torrent would want for the system that he's played with Pep, right? Pep played with Arturo Vidal and moved Kevin De Bruyne to the spot that's a box-to-box midfielder that Herrera is best suited for that team. So it just feels like these things are coming together for NYC to turn from bad to good really fast.
Chris,
it just seems tough to me that you're going to go into a playoff. You're going to have the rut you've had and then go into a playoff series and have Yangel Herrera playing at a high level and a system fitting around him comfortably when you need to be playing your best within a week.
Yeah, it just feels to me like time kind of ran out on them for the transition, both because of
injuries. If it was August 31st, I'd agree with you.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that they're going to win. It just feels like we're a little too down on them.
But who else? Okay, so who else are you lower on?
Columbus hasn't gotten as poor results as NYCFC, but they haven't really looked good in a few months.
I agree with that.
I mean, the defense has been great, but they have not been creating – they've not been scoring goals. They've been kind of creating them, but the sample size on Pedro Santos is big enough. He's going to miss opportunities. I'm down on Columbus right now.
Justin Miram hasn't been Justin Miram, or at least he hasn't been Columbus Justin Miram since he's come back, which I think was a lot to ask of him after a tough 6 months in Orlando. And just, hey, come back, reintegrate, be the best 11 caliber player that you were here before. I mean, humans have a tough time bouncing back from those sorts of personal and professional failures, which I think Orlando in a lot of ways was for Miram. He wanted to get out of the comfort zone. He did it. Unfortunately, he went into like the lion's den, so to speak, where everybody's just getting eaten alive this year. Coaches,
dude, there are so many lion references in that it was just too much.
Yeah. Look,
the
Justin
Orlando
Miram,
City Lions,
Justin
the Mesopotamia
Miram needs to be
Lions,
king of the jungle in Columbus. He's not yet back to that status. Trying to think of some other lion, references I can
next
make.
Next topic, please. Next
okay.
topic.
Yeah. He's kind of like Simba right now, but before Simba.
Next topic.
Okay.
Oh God, please.
Okay. Let's go to the Western Conference, 5 p.m. Eastern. The national TV game on this side is Minnesota LA Galaxy. They should be whipping you around on ESPN. Minnesota expects 50,000 plus fans at TCF Bank Stadium. They're sending that one off into the sunset because Allianz Field is coming online in 2019. It looks beautiful. Looks awesome. When they do the light up, it looks really, really cool. Zlatan says, in all likelihood, that he is the reason why these fans are coming. Quote, I owe them to come because apparently they're not coming for Minnesota. They're coming for me.
They're
of
coming
course.
For Fernando Bob. Everyone knows that.
Fred Bob is the big draw.
Yeah.
Unless Maximilianos gets to start. And then,
hopefully there's an Ibsen, Maximiliano, Fernando Bob trio in midfield.
Triumvirate, I might call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure.
Trident, perhaps.
No Harrison know. Heath in there, but I'm a bunch.
Either way, Zlatan's going to play on turf, it seems, for this occasion. It's because he needs to.
Yeah, they need to win.
Yeah, the LA Galaxy outside the playoff race right now, 45 points. Real Salt Lake will play on Thursday night, which we haven't really touched. We'll get to in a second. And then they play again on Sunday, and then they're done. They're in this very weird spot where LA Galaxy could know what they're trying to hit or whether they can even catch them after Sunday's action. 50,000, that's pretty cool. Allianz Field looks great. Minnesota are pretty objectively bad.
When you watch home Minnesota games, they're fun. It's a great atmosphere.
This is probably going to be the most fun game of the weekend. If this game's not 5-4, I will
right.
be upset.
It's going to be high scoring. It's going to be insanity. There's going to be moments you don't understand. And the atmosphere is going to spur the teams. And when you watch just a normal, quote-unquote, Minnesota United home game, it's fun to watch. So, I'm glad it's the national TV game, I would say. Even though it's not two playoff teams going up against each other, it's going to have the energy, I think, of that playoff atmosphere, which is all you can really ask for.
7 days ago, we would have said that Minnesota was the favorite. They were very good at home. Darwin Quintero, Miguel Ibarra, Angelo Rodriguez even scored.
Wait, hold on. But okay, then, I thought you were going to – never mind.
But then they dropped the egg against Colorado.
Yeah.
And it's like, God, Galaxy have to win this game.
They're squirting water bottles, acting a fool,
yeah.
trying to get in little scuffles at the end.
And Quintero missed one or two open looks, you could say, like headers from crosses. But I would say it was his quietest performance since he's come to MLS. I don't know if Colorado found anything that did that or he was just off one day. But I would agree with you, Bobby, that going before that game, you would have said like, oh, yeah, this actually – is a decent one for Minnesota. And now you look at it the other way and Minnesota has nothing to play for. And I don't know if I would start Angelo Rodriguez on my Tuesday night men's league team, but
this is where in another league, the owner would walk into the locker room and be like, if you guys win this game in front of 50,000 of Zlatan, here's $10,000 each.
The Panathinaikos owner just with checks.
Yeah.
It's like, I have a bag of cash right here. I also have something strapped to my belt that, we won't name later. Did you ever get in that situation? this is Greece, man. This is what happens in there. I'm pretty sure that happened. I'm pretty sure the owner of one of those clubs was actually carrying a weapon.
He was threatening a referee, I think.
Gotcha. Something terrible and awful that should not happen in the game of soccer. Did you ever get an offer like that?
No, Bobby only played in Scandinavia. Everything's above board in Scandinavia.
But they're like IKEA gift cards.
Yeah.
I did. We did have a
teammate. Buy you a coffee.
We did have a teammate that went to Greece for huge sums, and we talked to him. We checked in a month later. He was like, I haven't been paid. He was like, I'm not seeing any of that $5 million they promised me.
Whoa.
It wasn't that much, but.
Yeah, well, that's no good for them. There is some news about the Galaxy out there. Marca in Argentina, so take it with whatever grain of salt you would like, says that Dario Benedetto and perhaps Guillermo Barrichello are on their way to the Galaxy. Does that sound realistic? He says that they tried to sign them previously.
Well, I believe that they tried to sign Guillermo Barros-Colotta is super realistic, both now and in the past. So that part, yes. Benedetto in the past makes a lot of sense. He was at Club America, so he was already in North America. And then he went back down south. So I believe that they tried to sign him. Does it make any sense to sign him now? No. But it made no sense to sign Zlatan when you had Ola, and it made no sense to sign Giovanni Dos Santos when you had a soccer team that you were trying to build. So, like, I don't know that that's
what
we're...
It made sense, and they signed Gio. Stop.
Okay.
Well, Gio made more sense from the PR standpoint than he did the playing standpoint.
In the same way, if
he
they were...
He is who you thought he was.
Yeah, but they had to sign... We keep on doing this and giving the Galaxy a hard time.
We keep on...
They had to sign Gio. They really... We all... It was a unanimously good decision to sign Gio. In the same way that if Chicharito wanted to come, we'd be like, yeah, give him the $7 million.
But if you're going but if you're going to sign Giovanni Dos Santos, then what is the team you're building? Is it around him? And
come
if it's
on,
around
we're not
him,
children. We're not
who's
children.
In
there's,
it?
There's a business, bro. I mean, this
no,
is,
that's
this
fine.
Is, this is
but the
kid.
Point is, if you're going to sign him, how are you going to maximize him? And they've never attempted
right,
to do
that. But
that's
another question, right? That's a fair question. The idea that they shouldn't have signed Gio is stupid.
Okay, fine. But, yeah, how are you going to use it? How are you going to be a real soccer team? And they've never – they over the last 4 years, they haven't tried to do that.
In the same way that should they have signed Zlatan with the construction of their roster? Could they have used that $1.5 million to build a more balanced roster? Absolutely.
No.
And nobody says –
I don't
actually
agree with that at all.
No, no, the $1.5
million
they
have, like, seven guys in that position. Literally, they've got half their roster plays Zlatan's position.
What would you do that $1.5 million or that TAM slot? That's going to have a bigger impact on your team on the field than Zlatan.
No,
has.
But they
and
were in negotiations for Zlatan. They shouldn't have traded for Ola Kamara.
No. If they had spent $1.5 million on a lockdown center back,
name me the TAM center back in MLS that somebody went out and found that's locked down.
Well, that's
like, I feel like this is like a mythical thing.
Okay,
like,
so
the TAM center back that changes everything.
So it's
Ranzo Ziegler. Aaron Long, Tim Parker.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want me to keep naming
say they had
yeah, but Aaron Long and Tim Parker are not.
Tim
not
Parker's
Tam
a
Tam.
Well,
here's $1.5 million. Here's $1.5 million, Vancouver. Give us Tim Parker. Boom, that team wins the West.
I don't know if it's that simple.
I would say if you were going to bring in Zlatan, which you knew you were in negotiations for, and you knew his contract status, why are you trading Giassi Zardes? Just play Zardes for 5 months and say he's not good enough, and then Zlatan's your starter. Why did you go out and get Ola Kamara and then sign him to a contract extension, by the way? Because they did.
Yeah.
So now you're going to go out and get Dario De Benedetto, another straight center forward. Now you're going to get three of them. You're going to create a new formation where you're just going to play three dudes right in the middle of the box.
That is the part that is a mystery. They didn't know if they were going to get Zlatan. Everything they do over the last X number of years feels like just chucking hatchets at them. You know,
you and I asked a question. Would you rather run the Chicago Fire or the LA Galaxy right now? And you said Galaxy without a doubt. And I said, no, I'd rather have the Fire because there's all these other things when you're the LA Galaxy that you have to take into account outside of the lineup you put on the field. The Chicago Fire can say no to Zlatan if they want, right? They can say no to big stars because they don't have a general...
Anybody who cares right now? I mean...
If...
I don't know that they could say no because I don't know that the star would say yes. Right?
I mean, the difference is that at the Galaxy, yes, the constraints are different. And yes, you have a lot more pressure. And yes, you have to make signings and moves that don't always make complete sense, like in a very linear term. But at the Fire right now, they literally, their fans are saying, like, show us why we should care. Well, like, you don't even have any buy-in right now.
The mailbag is deep with that one.
Okay.
All right, we won't go too deep.
But the Galaxy has to meet certain obligations to their fan base, to the league. So.
Yeah, yeah. This is going to be a fun game. Point being, watch this game at 5 p.m. FC Dallas, Sporting Kansas City, massive match. You guys talked about it. Sporting KC has an opportunity to basically control their own destiny here at the top of the Western Conference. They've got Dallas this Sunday, the LAFC the next Sunday. Those are the two teams they're competing with to both win the conference but also get a bye, which they desperately want and need. Looks like they probably will avoid the knockout round, but they got to get a result. Like, I think more importantly is the LAFC one. But if they win against Dallas, LFC drops against Vancouver, all of a sudden they feel really secure. Let's go to the Dallas side. Regular season versus playoff team. I've had a hard time talking about Dallas all year long. A lot of times they don't inspire me. A lot of times their results are good, and I can't find something that I really want to talk about. They're consistent. They're consistent. They find a way to grind out results. Oscar Pareja has a team with a lot of interchangeable parts, and he's changed him around a little bit, and he's found places for guys like Max Jarrutti to be a little bit different than just kind of the hot, cold guy he was before. Their defense is good. Rito Ziegler has been good. I'll give you that. Matt Hedges has been good. Reggie Cannon's had a huge introductory season. Are they built for the playoffs? Can they be a successful playoff team? Is there a difference?
I think they can be in the Western Conference right now. I don't know that there's a team in the Western Conference. I think LAFC would be the caveat, but I don't know if they're there right now. That blows you off the field. And so now you're talking about all low-scoring series that you're grinding things out. And who's better at that in the Western Conference than FC Dallas?
I disagree with multiple things you just said.
Just say it.
Just throw it out there then.
I mean, SKC passes almost everyone off the field.
No, but I meant
Seattle,
yeah, but
lately
how,
passes
but we just
everyone.
Said, first of all, SKC has not been able to get over the hump against most teams, and you especially talked about how they make the wrong decisions in the final third and don't score goals.
Yes, yeah,
I think
did.
The difference is like LAFC could end a series against you in 30 minutes.
Boom.
They could go out and score four goals, and you're like, oh, crap, we're not going to come back. And their defense is good enough, and their ability to possess the ball and just kind of kill off games is good enough that they can kind of slowly strangle you once they get that kind of knockout blow in.
If, like, Vela and Rossi and Diamante are all on.
For sure.
Blah, blah, blah.
And, you know, like, maybe, you know, all of a sudden Christian Ramirez comes off the bench in a game that you're like, all right, we're just keeping the damage minimal, and he scores two off nothing. You know, they have a lot of weapons, and those weapons.
And Atlanta and the Red Bulls can also do that.
They both can do that as well. I think Sporting KC can do that against bad teams, Vancouver, San Jose. We've seen that. Teams that, like, Vancouver basically gave up. Two of these goals came in stoppage time. Vancouver put their head down. Jake Derwinski, like, just didn't even track balls back there in stoppage time. There's pass-ins. They tapped it in. Busio flubbed it in. He didn't even have to hit that thing well. Like, I think you are right, though, that the rest of the Western Conference will leave an opening for you if you aren't on your game that day. And that's where maybe FC Dallas steps in and says, actually, we don't need to have that blow-away day. We need to have the day where we're at 100%. We're at like 85 all the time, and it's pretty good, and it works against just about everybody. I don't know. I feel like you had more formulated thoughts about playoff first regular season.
Yeah, that's. I just wonder if to do well over 34 games to get a high seed going to the playoffs requires different players than to do well in the playoffs. And I think about the old Galaxy teams with Beckham and Keane and Landon and Mike McGee, who they weren't going to grind for 34 games. They would. There's no chance they would ever beat this FC Dallas team to a higher seed through the regular season.
See, but I don't know about that. They had historic seasons like that. They won shields. They had a back line of midfield in Juninho,
what were their
and Sarvas, and then AJ De La Garza.
Well, the
and
year in 2014
Omar
that Seattle won Supporters Shield, the Galaxy, I think, also put up like an all-time great points number.
But for the most part, they were coasting.
Yeah, you're right. They were a team that wanted to get third seed and just get into the playoffs. Yeah.
If you go into a playoff series, are we sure that we don't prefer the Galaxy over FC? Anyway, I think that to have the idea of having a team that can win over 34 games is different than having a team that can win over one game or over two games.
What is the team that can win over one or two games in your mind? What defines that team?
More talent. I mean, one of the most frustrating facts in the world is that talented players are enigmatic. Right? They're mercurial, whatever soccer word you want to use, but they're not always there. And then when they are there, when they are playing 100%, they're better. But most of the time, those players are playing at not 100%. And when they're not 100%, the less talented players beat them. So when you've got the slug of a season, the guys that show up and play 100% often do better over 34 games, but as it gets to the playoffs, the more talented players are playing at 100%, they have the advantage.
I'm trying to think through Dallas's roster right now. Mosquera.
They're all guys who are like,
Barrios,
maybe.
Who starts for LAFC? Hedges.
What do you mean?
Who on FC Dallas?
I think Rito Ziegler would have a pretty good chance of getting
got
into
it.
That team.
I think Walker Zimmerman? Maybe. Okay, we'll give it a wash.
I think Reggie
maybe
Cannon
Danilo,
would start.
One of those two.
Reggie Cannon over Betashore?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Cannon's a good call. Maybe goalkeeper.
I don't think sometimes we say things, and I want to be like, honestly, if your job was on the line tomorrow, if you would start Reggie Cannon over Seton Betashore in a playoff game?
Yeah, no, that's a good question because you're talking about veteran versus young guy. But, like, over the course of 34 games plus
– this is my point.
Who would I sign?
But we're going to a playoff game. We're in a playoff series. Tomorrow we play in a single elimination game. Are you going to put your life, your livelihood on the line with Reggie Cannon or Seton Betashore?
I guess Betashore. But then I would put it on with Ziegler, then Zimmerman probably as well.
This is a good point of the kind of like
so two FC
livelihood
one.
On the yeah. line aspect of going to these games.
The only
we sit here and fall in love with these guys. And we're like, oh man, Reggie Cannon, he's the future. You know, not necessarily acknowledging that, like in that one game, in that moment where you need a little bit of, you know, institutional knowledge, mm-hmm. when you need that confidence that comes from having done it, maybe it's not the right guy.
The other one you would say is like, okay, well, if you change the way you play a little, Grueso might be in there because you'd play an actual defensive midfielder.
No, he doesn't play that.
But that's fine. No. Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but also I'm just looking back. The LA Galaxy in 2010 put up 59 points and the Colorado Rapids won MLS Cup. It doesn't always work that the best players
right. This is not a steadfast rule at all. And like I said on the show all the time, I'm not positive about this. This is something I think about. The other thing I think about FC Dallas is, man, counterattacking, it keeps you in every game, right? And I just wrote the article where if you have a passing team and if LAFC or SKC aren't on or Seattle aren't on a given day, FC Dallas, as you guys said, is going to be at 85%. You know what they're going to do. So
or the weather's bad.
Or the weather's bad, right?
Like, you know, the ball skips or you have a VAR decision.
Yeah.
Or
like, FC Dallas might not be the best team, but I think they're pretty well suited to win a playoff series just from sitting and getting their chances on the break.
What I've been thinking about a lot is if I was an RSL fan or player or coach, I'd be pretty unhappy about the way the schedule is laid out. Because
100%.
They're done this week. They don't get a rebuttal on decision day. They don't get an opportunity to watch the scoreboard and control their own fate on
that day. And score the stoppage time goal that San Jose scored.
Exactly.
To sneak in.
They're
going to
have to sit at home and watch.
In fairness, though, if they go out and lose to the Revs tonight and go out and lose.
The whole thing's their own fault, probably. That doesn't mean you can't be upset about it, though.
You know what would be good content? If we get Mike Petke on Match Day Central that last Sunday.
That would. Actually, you're going to have to write an email after this. They host New England on Thursday, that is today, 9 p.m. Eastern. So that's a huge result from them. They got to win at home. New England is moribund on the road, and New England are just kind of like sad right now and no fun. Then they go back and they play Portland to end their regular season. I don't have any faith in them right now. They go to Portland to do that. They're up 1 point on the Galaxy. They're probably going to miss Rusnak, Plata, and Savarino in addition to Beckerman and Sonny on this Thursday, in arguably their biggest game of the season. That's another reason why you would be mad at the schedule if you're a RSL fan, player, or coach. The international break butted right up on this game for you.
It's the bigger reason. They might play, right? They have Michael Bradley play it a day after getting back. Yes, it was in-country. I mean, they might play.
I don't know. We'll see. I wouldn't be happy if I was RSL. I do want to address one thing before we get to the break. I know you're hurrying me on, Dave. Did we see Brad Friedel's comments about locker rooms? About how it should be like, basically that nobody should like each other and that you should try to, you know, push all your competitors out. I get that. I've been trying to push you guys out for better part of, you know, 5 years with Dave. Can't get rid of him. We're just starting on you, Bobby. Mm-hmm. No, I'm just kidding. I welcome you guys. I shake your hand every morning.
Bobby, we're slowly 5 more minutes late every day for every month that you're with us.
So
in 2 years, we're going to show up 4 hours late.
Brad Friedel basically said, you know, he wants to get it to that in locker rooms here, and he thinks it will happen. This kind of, like, cutthroat competitiveness, this is a business, it's a livelihood, watch out, I'm trying to take your job, and I don't like you. How did you experience MLS locker rooms versus foreign locker rooms, Bobby? Is this what you experienced?
My first experience in an MLS locker room, I was in college, and I went to train other team, and I was just going to train with them. I wasn't on trial, I wasn't trying to sign with the team. Not a single person came up and said hello.
What team was this?
I'm not going to say.
Okay.
I'm not going to say. But I remember that moment, and I promised myself that for the rest of my career, I would always be the one to say hi. And I would like to think that – I wouldn't like to think. Undoubtedly, I would crush that guy in practice, and I would yell at him, and I wanted him to fail. But I have no problem showing humanity in that moment. So, I mean, I understand where Brad Friedel's coming from. And it is true, there are some guys who don't say hi and there are some that do, but I refuse to think that you can't be a decent human to someone and also fight for your life to make sure he doesn't take your spot.
3 p.m. Eastern Conference games on Sunday. ESPN is the spot for the national TV. You've got Atlanta-Chicago at 3 and then at 5 with the Western Conference games. Minnesota-LA Galaxy, all the coverage. MLSsoccer.com, pre- and post-game, by the way. Mentioned Matchday Central. Pre- and post-game this weekend. Hour-long shows. All the action, all the highlights, all the scuttlebutt, all the banter, all the analysis that you need. We're going to go to break on the other side, the mailbag.
We want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
You stick out of the crowd, baby, it's a no-brainer. It ain't the hard to choose. Him or me, be for real, baby, it's a no-brainer. You got your mind on loose.
Back down, Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental, hanging out in Brooklyn at the Goss Abode, the Goss House, the club. I don't know. Do you have a name for this? Is there a nickname or just the apartment?
No, there isn't a nickname yet, which is frustrating because normally I do have good nicknames for my places.
What was the last apartment's nickname? I mean, for me, it was...
Everyone just called it Harlem.
Yeah, 101. Yeah. I mean, it's like just an address.
Yeah, everyone just called it Harlem. My place in college, we lived on Bernie Street, and everyone called it the Bernie, and it was perfect. It was when the dance was the kind of a thing, too. So it worked out well.
Like Bernie. Yeah, there you go. For sure. 401-206-0MLS. That's the Hot Take Hotline. Call us, text us, email us at extratime@mlssoccer.com. Again, a reminder, 3 p.m., 5 p.m., those are the game windows on Sunday, MLS Match Day Central. Myself, Bobby Warshaw, Matt Doyle, Kaylin Carr on location in, I think, D.C. and Dallas, Jillian Sakovitz and Susanna Collins. We've got the pregame, the postgame for you. We're taking your questions. Hit us up. Enjoy those games with us. And before we get to the mail, U.S. national team, the window is over. We will not dissect this. We'll not spend a ton of time there, but I want your one big takeaway. International game is a slow drip. We always want just a little bit more. We very rarely get it. In this case, injuries, the lack of a permanent head coach. You know, there are a lot of caveats there, but there's always something. What's your something that you're taking away or thinking about?
Aaron Long can play at that level. Josh Sargent is really exciting. Timothy Weah real excited. We could dig into those.
Any desire to dig into one or none? Aaron Long?
I find Aaron Long to be really interesting because he has basically played at the same level at every level he's been at, if that makes sense. He's been, you know, like an above average, not great, but an above average player, but he's been that same above average at USL and MLS, and he wasn't in his one national team cap. And he just gives off that personality where he's not phased, right? I'm not worried about him stepping up levels. I think if he were to go to Europe, he would be that same type of player because he's not phased. He's got the physical abilities. He doesn't get in his own head. So I'm interested to see how he continues to do playing at that higher level and if he keeps his game at the same place.
I agree with what Bobby said. And I like Timothy Weah a lot. I really enjoy watching him play. I thought Josh Sargent was phenomenal in this game besides the goal. And some of the things that I see in him, which is what excites me, is this ability for all of the attackers of what we think will be the USMNT, ability to flow in and out of positions and find other part of the game in other places. I thought Josh Sargent, after the beginning of the game, when it's like, all right, we're not going to have possession, he's dropping back and winning tackles 35 yards from goal, trying to link up with teammates and find the game a little bit more. And he helped their team a lot. And then Timothy Weah can come inside and play more as a center forward or pick up the ball and attack center backs, which is really tough for guys because of his speed. I thought Kellen Acosta had a really good week. I think he showed that he can play at this level as well and not just, you know, do a job or carry water, but, like, you can play through his feet at this level so he can be a part of this. Tyler Adams and McKenney and whoever else is in this conversation of, like, guys that maybe can have the U.S. play in a different style than what we've seen. So I would say those were the big ones for me along with everyone that Bobby said.
Sargent's coach, Huerta Brumman, says that the period in which Josh plays exclusively in the U23s is over. He looks to be a long way beyond that now. So it sounds like Sargent will start to get some opportunities in the Bundesliga with the first team Werder Bremen up near the top of the table right now. So we'll see what sort of opportunities those are. Are they off the bench, et cetera? I think my takeaway, to take it away from the player side and to take it to Dave Sarokin, is that I'm not sure Dave Sarokin has gotten enough credit for what he's done in the past year because he came into a situation where he had the stain of Kuva and the stain of being Bruce's assistant on him. And I don't think, rightfully so, that will ever go away. And I think he understands that. But he had a very impatient, frustrated, angry fan base. He had uncertainty as to the team itself. How are they going to reintegrate some of the older players in? Were they going to do that at all? What young players were going to get opportunities? Where were those young players going to get opportunities? It hasn't been perfect. Tactically, it hasn't always been the best. But he gave opportunities to, I think at this point, 19 new faces. He didn't get blown out. Didn't have any games where he felt embarrassed, I don't feel like. He had some decent results. Some good performances.
Yeah,
they had a good schedule. I just think we'll look back on this year and be like, man, that job would not be fun if you're Dave Sarokin. Like, it's just a lot. Everybody doubts you. Nobody thinks that you're the right guy. You're kind of a, you know, you're kind of hanging in this nether region of, okay, I'm the head coach, but I'm not going to be the head coach. Like, it's just, it's not an admirable place to be put, and I think Sarokin did a pretty admirable job under the conditions.
One other piece I want to throw out there about this, because I'm pointing at Bobby right now. We've talked about this a lot, and all of us have, is this generation better than other generations? I don't know. But they're going to be given an opportunity. And maybe every, you know, quote-unquote youth generation of the U.S. soccer would be as good as this one maybe will be if they had all been given starts at the age of 19. But they're not going to. But like Weeby said, Dave Sarokin gave all those guys chances now. And so they might grow into better players than what we saw in the past where guys were lost that were, you know, USU 20 stars or were training at Ajax or training at Real Sociedad or wherever else because they just never got the opportunities. So that's something that might be out there. We got a lot of questions about the U.S. Wow, Yedlin just got called ball watching at back post. Maybe he needs to ride the bench back at Seattle. I'm also astonished that Guzan is still in our national team keeper pool.
Nobody should be surprised about Guzan. I'm not sure anybody should be surprised about the Yedlin play either. I mean, he comes off the bench. He lost focus.
He probably doesn't even want to go in at that point.
It's not the first time.
He wants to go in to get the bonus, but he's like, you're not going to start me. Don't play. He probably didn't even want to be in.
Jeff in Tucson says, question of the day, would either of the starting lineups from the last two USMNT games beat the current Canadian team? I'm thinking not. He also says, size note, let Bobby know I'm the first passenger on his new Colorado train for 2019.
Well, what's this Colorado train?
I don't know. I think Jeff
the Jack Price.
I think
Express,
Jeff and
I saw Jack Price's usage rate is number one in Major League Soccer.
Let's go.
I did see that. What was the first question? I had an answer to that. No,
would the U.S. team from this camp beat the current Canadian national team?
I think it'd be a pretty good game. I just think the Canadian national team still so many questions. Like we say all the time on the back line. Like Jonathan Osorio said it, you know, these Dominica games, these like CONCACAF Nations League games are good for us because it helps us kind of build up confidence and belief in who we are. But I'm not sure that we've yet had an opportunity to see Canada against an actual good team. I'm not saying the U.S. is necessarily that right now, that these lineups aren't necessarily that. But I think across the board, top to bottom, the U.S. still has more talent.
It's going to be a fun Gold Cup in 2019. I'm pumped about that. Austin and Fort Worth, we talk about the summer of 2009 like it was a golden year for USMNT, but I remember us being beaten badly by Italy and Brazil and only getting to beat Spain because we lucked out on crazy results to get second in the group. Then we blew a 2-0 lead in the final. We lost three games and won two that summer. With that said, am I crazy for wanting Bradley to be the next USMNT coach? Well, first of all, Austin, you're wrong about 2009. I read this email so that I could get myself upset, so I could say we blew out Egypt 3-0. We outplayed Spain every way we had to. And, yes, we went up 2-0 against Brazil in the final, and then we lost. We also beat Honduras right before that in a huge World Cup qualifier before we went to South Africa. So get out of my face, Austin Fort Worth, but he does want Bob Bradley back. Does anyone feel anything
that
about that?
2009 Confederations Cup. I remember how that was like right in the time when I was falling in love with professional soccer, where I was like, you know, the 06 World Cup had gotten me into it and I'd gone down the rabbit hole and I was really, really kind of saying to myself, okay, this is going to be my future. I'm going to find a way to do something with soccer and specifically domestic soccer. And I remember I had to tape that Spain game, DVR'd it. Watching the first half, and my roommate comes in, and he's like, whoa, did you see that goal that Josie scored? And I remember throwing something against my wall and breaking it because I was so upset that that moment was lost for me. And I still celebrated it when it did come as if it was live, just kind of like this gift to myself. But that whole tournament was incredible. And I remember going up on Brazil and just being like, we are going to do this. Yeah. This is it. These are beautiful goals. You know, like, catch me on the break, Selecao. We got you. Nice. And then, you know, we know what happened from then.
Yeah, but anyone who's going to dishonor the history is beautiful. Brutal.
I want to dig that into brutal. Yeah. Can we make that a thing?
Asa and Cascadia. I'm generally swayed by Bobby's argument, but the take, I don't really understand that. That USMNT needs to have a style that appeals to the archetypal American sports fan is one I'm not buying. I've seen too many of my raised in AYSO peers grow up and continue to love the game to believe that soccer fandom in this country is on anything but an upward trajectory. Casual fans of any sport are going to jump on and off bad bandwagons of winners. But if that's what the American Soccer Project created to, then MLS would have been NASL 2.0. Give us a good team with a style to match the pieces we have available, and we'll enjoy watching it.
So this is the debate between what? The debate between, like, how people think we should play, kind of the theoretical versus the practical, which is what Claudio Reyna was talking about with SI, which is results first, fit your system to the personnel, but then that fits to the coach because he chooses the personnel.
Not always with national teams, because you have a certain pool that you can pull from.
For sure, but
you can make decisions in that pool, but, you know, if you don't have a type of player, you can't play a certain way.
True.
I'm okay with
it's a tough question to answer because so much of it is just kind of like ephemeral. Like you're trying to I'm trying to understand this question, and I do ultimately think that number one for casual fandom, for the U.S. national team, for MLS to be big is winning, or like the perception of being winners, which is in some ways why CCL is so important. Not necessarily because I think a bunch of casual fans will be like, oh my God, you beat Chivas Guadalajara, we're into the league. But it's more like MLS can be on a stage where you as a sports fan can be like, oh, wow, Toronto FC are about to go play Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Club World Cup, that sounds epic and cool. Oh, MLS is involved. There's just like some cred you get from rubbing shoulders in those situations the league's just never gotten. So I guess what I'm saying is success reigns supreme in my mind. Style's nice.
I think we're romanticizing the past, guys. Like, listen, it was great having Bob Bradley as coach, but I think all of us here, even people who love Bob Bradley and what he was building, were like, come on, like, aren't we past the point of sitting and countering? You know?
But then the question is, are we past the point now?
Yeah, but as
many years later.
But yes, we should try and move past it.
Even if the results are terrible, let's say we try to move past it and the result is that you don't.
You have to, but especially with your national team, right? You need to do and play a way that inspires and invigorates your country and just makes them love the game. And if we are sitting deep and countering and we are getting results, we've done that before, right? For the most part, we got pretty good results under Bob Bradley. And Bob even played way more adventurous than people give him credit for. But at the time, it felt like he was sitting and countering. People were angry about it. And most of those games we watched, even if we won, it was like, God, we only had to sit and counter to beat this team. It was ugly. It wasn't fun. And I think we need more.
That's interesting. I was just thinking about the England national team this summer and how they inspired their fandom, but like wasn't exactly how I would say I won to watch a team. But let's move on to MLS. If San Jose fired Starry after less than a season, is it plausible that James O'Connor doesn't come back for next year?
I mean, they'd have to, I presume he signed a contract, so they'd have to pay him out if they let him go. But this is worst case scenario for James O'Connor. Like, you walk into a situation that was bad, and it's worse, and you have a bunch of guys who just don't even look like they are engaged.
Like, yeah.
I don't know. This is a terrible situation for James O'Connor to be in, and maybe they have to turn over the roster, because if you bring this whole group back, I just don't see how it gets better next year. From a, you know, talent standpoint, from a chemistry standpoint, from just kind of a souring of the entire thing.
Yeah.
I don't envy James O'Connor. I don't at all.
Last one here from Daniel West in Pasadena. I'm a huge college football fan. One of the best traditions in the sport is that the last game of the season is always played against your biggest rival. And then he gave examples, but I think we all know about college football. How epic would it be if MLS scheduling made sure one of the rivalry matches for each team always fell on the final day of the regular season? Imagine a league-wide rivalry week taking place with games starting at the same time and with playoff places on the line. Every team completely out of the playoff picture would have something huge to play for. That's what happens all the time in college football, leads to some amazing and unexpected upsets.
I have multiple thoughts on this. Can I?
Yeah, go for it.
No. One is, I'm curious our crossover between the MLS podcast and a college football podcast.
Probably not very heavy.
Yeah.
The examples he gave were USC, UCLA, Notre Dame, or someone.
Do most college football teams play their rival in the last game?
I know that I think Ohio State and Michigan do.
Every year it's the last
game?
Texas
and Oklahoma
so.
Don't usually. Theirs is usually, I think, based around
Thanksgiving?
Yeah, earlier than that, I think. Like, I think they've already played this year.
Stanford-Cal play near the end. I'm not sure if it's the last every year. But
I'm pretty sure Ohio State-Michigan play the last game of every season.
The other thing,
because they used to not have a championship game, so it would, like, decide a lot of times who was the Big Ten champion.
I'm a believer in, life that you should separate. It's better to have really great things a couple times than like the ultimate thing once. Like for cheeseburgers, I don't understand why anybody wants a double cheeseburger. Why wouldn't you just have two cheeseburgers? You know, is the double cheeseburger that much better that you wouldn't just rather have an awesome cheeseburger twice?
Well, if they're the thin, like, crispy patties.
I knew that Weenie was about to get into this.
Yes, that is better. Then the double is better. But if they're the thick patties, of course, never go with the double. It's too much meat. Your proportions are off. I think this situation, like, very practically, if you're MLS, TV ratings matter a lot to you. Fact. They do. They have to. That is the biggest revenue driver in professional sports. Look around. We're watching NBA games the day after while we do something else. These are the ratings that the NBA needs that they get their billion-dollar contracts off of. MLS needs as well. So for MLS, you have rivalry weeks, and they've cut down on those a little bit. But they don't want to dilute those when you already have these final 2 weeks of the regular season with so much on the line that has a natural hook to it. Now, the question is whether that hook is good enough. We go through that every single national TV date. In this league, it's why we all pay attention to what the numbers are, where they're going, what the trends are. But I just think the more days you have that have a natural reason to watch, whether that's rivalries or playoff seeding or stakes or whatever, that's a good thing for MLS. So I love the idea. Just like you, Bobby, like in a vacuum, the double cheeseburger sounds great. I just think practically it doesn't make as much sense.
I'll bet everyone here money that Weeby leaves here and gets a double cheeseburger.
Nah, man, we had ramen for lunch. I gotta be somewhat responsible. Is that it? We got anything else?
No.
401-206-0MLS. It's been a fun time hanging out at the humble abode of one David Goss. That's it for us. Watch the games on Sunday, 3 and 5 p.m. ESPN is the spot for those. MLS Match Day Central before and after. We'll be back on Monday to break it all down. Have a good weekend, everybody.